Chapter 20. Unsteadily, a shovel was scraping loose coal down below. A fire door clanged. Stern on the bridge, began whistling a new tune. Captain Wally, sitting on the couch, awake and fully dressed, heard the door of his cabin open. He did not move in the least, waiting to recognize the voice, with an appalling strain of prudence. A bulkhead lamp blazed on the white paint, the crimson plush, the brown varnish of mahogany tops. The white wood packing case under the bed place had remained unopened for 3 years now, as though Captain Wally had felt that, after the fair maid was gone, there could be no abiding place on earth for his affections. His hands rested on his knees. His handsome head with big eyebrows presented a rigid profile to the doorway. The expected voice spoke out at last. "Once more, then. What am I to call you?" "Ha! Massey." Again. The weariness of it crushed his heart, and the pain of shame was almost more than he could bear without crying out. "Well, is it to be partner still? You don't know what you ask." "I know what I want." Dot, Massey stepped in, and closed the door. ... "And I am going to have a try for it with you once more." His whine was half persuasive, half menacing. "For it's no manner of use to tell me that you are poor. You don't spend anything on yourself, that's true enough, but there's another name for that. You think you are going to have what you want out of me for 3 years, and then cast me off without hearing what I think of you. You think I would have submitted to your heirs if I had known you had only a beggarly £500 in the world. You ought to have told me." "Perhaps," said Captain Wally, bowing his head. "And yet it has saved you." Massey laughed scornfully. "Have told you often enough since. And I don't believe you now. When I think how I let you lord it over my ship. Do you remember how you used to bullyrag me about my coat and your bridge? It was in his way. His bridge. And I won't be a party to this, and I couldn't think of doing that. Honest man. And now it all comes out. I am poor, and I can't. I have only this 500 in the world." He contemplated the immobility of Captain Wally that seemed to present an inconquerable obstacle in his path. His face took a mournful cast. "You are a hard man." "Enough," said Captain Wally, turning upon him. "You shall get nothing from me, because I have nothing of mine to give away now. Tell that to the Marines." Mr. Massey, going out, looked back once, then the door closed, and Captain Wally, alone, sat as still as before. He had nothing of his own, even his past of honor, of truth, of just pride, was gone. All his spotless life had fallen into the abyss. He had said his last goodbye to it. But what belonged to her, that he meant to save? Only a little money. He would take it to her in his own hands, this last gift of a man that had lasted too long. And an immense and fierce impulse, the very passion of paternity, flamed up with all the unquenched vigor of his worthless life in a desire to see her face. Just across the deck, Massey had gone straight to his cabin, struck a light, and hunted up the note of the dream number whose figures had flamed up also with the fierceness of another passion. He must contrive somehow not to miss a drawing. That number meant something. But what expedient could he contrive to keep himself going? "Wretched miser," he mumbled. If Mr. Stern could at no time have told him anything new about his partner, he could have told Mr. Stern that another use could be made of a man's affliction than just to kick him out, and thus defer the term of a difficult payment for a year. To keep the secret of the affliction, and induce him to stay, was a better move. If without means, he would be anxious to remain, and that settled the question of refunding him his share. He did not know exactly how much Captain Wally was disabled, but if it so happened that he put the ship ashore somewhere for good and all, it was not the owner's fault, was it? He was not obliged to know that there was anything wrong. But probably nobody would raise such a point, and the ship was fully insured. He had had enough self-restraint to pay up the premiums. But this was not all. He could not believe Captain Welly to be so confoundedly destitute as not to have some more money put away somewhere. If he, Massey, could get hold of it, that would pay for the boilers, and everything went on as before. And if she got lost in the end, so much the better. He hated her. He loathed the troubles that took his mind off the chances of fortune. He wished her at the bottom of the sea, and the insurance money in his pocket. And as, baffled, he left Captain Wally's cabin, he enveloped in the same hatred the ship with the worn-out boilers, and the man with the dimmed eyes. And our conduct after all is so much a matter of outside suggestion, that had it not been for his Jack's drunken gabble he would have there, and then had it out with this miserable man, who would neither help, nor stay, nor yet lose the ship. The old fraud. He longed to kick him out. But he restrained himself. Time enough for that when he liked. There was a fearful new thought put into his head. Wasn't he up to it after all? How that beast Jack had raved. And a safe trick to get rid of her. Well, Jack was not so far wrong. A very clever trick had occurred to him. Aye. But what of the risk? A feeling of pride, the pride of superiority, two common prejudices crept into his breast, made his heart beat fast, his mouth turn dry. Not everybody would dare, but he was Massey, and he was up to it. 6 bells were struck on deck. 11. He drank a glass of water, and sat down for 10 minutes or so to calm himself. Then he got out of his chest a small bullseye lantern of his own and lit it. Almost opposite his berth, across the narrow passage under the bridge, there was, in the iron deck structure covering the stokehold fiddle and the boiler space, a storeroom with iron sides, iron roof, iron-plated floor too, on account of the heat below. All sorts of rubbish was shot there. It had a mound of scrap iron in a corner, rows of empty oil cans, sacks of cotton waste, with a heap of charcoal, a deck forge, fragments of an old hen coop, winch covers all in rags, remnants of lamps, and a brown felt hat, discarded by a man dead now of a fever on the Brazil coast, who had been once mate of the Cephala, had remained for years jammed forcibly behind a length of burst copper pipe, flung at some time or other out of the engine room. A complete and imperious blackness pervaded that capharnaum of forgotten things. A small shaft of light from Mr. Massey's bullseye fell slanting right through it. His coat was unbuttoned. He shot the bolt of the door, there was no other opening, and, squatting before the scrap heap, began to pack his pockets with pieces of iron. He packed them carefully, as if the rusty nuts, the broken bolts, the links of cargo chain, had been so much gold he had that one chance to carry away. He packed his side pockets till they bulged, the breast pocket, the pockets inside. He turned over the pieces. Some he rejected. A small mist of powdered rust began to rise about his busy hands. Mr. Massey knew something of the scientific basis of his clever trick. If you want to deflect the magnetic needle of a ship's compass, soft iron is the best. Likewise, many small pieces in the pockets of a jacket would have more effect than a few large ones, because in that way you obtain a greater amount of surface for weight in your iron, and it's surface that tells. He slipped out swiftly, 2 strides sufficed, and in his cabin he perceived that his hands were all red with rust. It disconcerted him, as though he had found them covered with blood. He looked himself over hastily. Why, his trousers too. He had been rubbing his rusty palms on his legs. He tore off the waistband button in his haste, brushed his coat, washed his hands. Then the air of guilt left him, and he sat down to wait. He sat bolt upright and waited with iron in his chair. He had a hard, lumpy bulk against each hip, felt the scrappy iron in his pockets touch his ribs at every breath, the downward drag of all these pounds hanging upon his shoulders. He looked very dull too, sitting idle there, and his yellow face, with motionless black eyes, had something passive and sad in its quietness. When he heard 8 bells struck above his head, he rose and made ready to go out. His movements seemed aimless. His lower lip had dropped a little. His eyes roamed about the cabin, and the tremendous tension of his will had robbed them of every vestige of intelligence. With the last stroke of the bell, the Serang appeared noiselessly on the bridge to relieve the mate. Stern overflowed with good nature, since he had nothing more to desire. Got your eyes well open yet, Serang? It's middling dark. I'll wait till you get your sight properly. The old Malay murmured, looked up with his worn eyes, sidled away into the light of the binnacle, and, crossing his hands behind his back, fixed his eyes on the compass card. You'll have to keep a good lookout ahead for land, about 3:30. It's fairly clear, though. You have looked in on the captain as you came along, eh? He knows the time? Well, then, I am off. At the foot of the ladder he stood aside for the captain. He watched him go up with an even, certain tread, and remained thoughtful for a moment. "'Tis funny," he said to himself, "but you can never tell whether that man has seen you or not. He might have heard me breathe this time. He was a wonderful man, when all was said and done. They said he had had a name in his day. Mr. Stern could well believe it, and he concluded serenely that Captain Wally must be able to see people more or less as himself just now, for instance, but not being certain of anybody, had to keep up that unnoticing silence of manner for fear of giving himself away. Mr. Stern was a shrewd guesser. This necessity of every moment brought home to Captain Wally's heart the humiliation of his falsehood. He had drifted into it from paternal love, from incredulity, from boundless trust in divine justice meted out to men's feelings on this earth. He would give his poor Ivy the benefit of another month's work. Perhaps the affliction was only temporary. Surely God would not rob his child of his power to help, and cast him naked into a night without end. He had caught at every hope, and when the evidence of his misfortune was stronger than hope, he tried not to believe the manifest thing. In vain. In the steadily darkening universe, a sinister clearness fell upon his ideas. In the illuminating moments of suffering, he saw life, men, all things, the whole earth with all her burden of created nature, as he had never seen them before. Sometimes he was seized with a sudden vertigo and an overwhelming terror, and then the image of his daughter appeared. Her too, he had never seen so clearly before. Was it possible that he should ever be unable to do anything whatever for her? Nothing. And not see her anymore? Never. Why? The punishment was too great for a little presumption, for a little pride. And at last he came to cling to his deception with a fierce determination, to carry it out to the end, to save her money intact, and behold her once more with his own eyes. Afterwards what? The idea of suicide was revolting to the vigor of his manhood. He had prayed for death till the prayers had stuck in his throat. All the days of his life he had prayed for daily bread, and not to be led into temptation, in a childlike humility of spirit. Did words mean anything? Whence did the gift of speech come? The violent beating of his heart reverberated in his head seemed to shake his brain to pieces. He sat down heavily in the deck chair to keep the pretense of his watch. The night was dark. All the nights were dark now. Serang, he said, half aloud. Ada, Tuan. I am here. There are clouds on the sky? There are, Tuan. Let her be steered straight. North. She is going north, Tuan. The Serang stepped back. Captain Wally Recog. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.